This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, November 16th. I'm Eric Latch, writer and editor of The New Yorker's online news column, The Current, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden. On Monday night, almost a full week after the polls closed on the 2018 midterm elections, officials in Arizona announced that the Democrat, Kyrsten Sinema, had won the state's open Senate seat. She's the first Democrat elected to the Senate from Arizona in 30 years, and will be the first female senator in Arizona history. In contrast to progressive insurgent candidates such as Beto O'Rourke in Texas, Sinema ran a centrist campaign, avoiding more controversial progressive initiatives. She didn't call to abolish ICE or to establish Medicare for all. In a debate with the Republican candidate Martha McSally in October, Sinema explicitly distanced herself from the Democratic Party in Washington.
And folks know in Arizona, always put their interests first, never party. So as you mentioned, Ted, I often do vote against my own party. And that's something I think Arizonans depend on and are proud of. They want an independent voice in the United States Congress. And what they want in the United States Senate is someone they know who stands up for them, not just does what party leaders tell them to do.
John Cassidy joins me to discuss how the election results might inform future campaign strategy in red states, and what the different factions of Democrats in Congress are hoping to achieve as they look ahead to 2020. Hi, John. It's great to have you.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me on.
So earlier this week, you wrote a piece for NewYorker.com that said that Sinema's victory was arguably the biggest win for Democrats since Donald Trump was elected. Martha McSally, the Republican in the race, wasn't the Trumpiest candidate, but she did adopt a Trumpist posture as the campaign went on. What made Sinema's win bigger than other significant Democratic victories of the past 2 years, in your opinion?
Well, obviously, I was being a little provocative there, saying it's the most important. But I think it was a very important turning point in some ways for the Democratic Party. I mean, they, as you mentioned in your introduction, they haven't won a Senate seat in Arizona since the 1980s, and they haven't won an open Senate seat there since 1976. And ever since then, the whole sort of Reagan, Goldwater, Republican Party has looked upon, you know, Arizona as part of the great Sun Belt coalition, which gave the Republicans their semi-automatic majority for a lot of years. Now, as you mentioned also in your introduction, Sinema didn't run as a progressive Democrat or anything like it. She ran as a very independent-minded Democrat. She sided with Trump on the border wall and several other issues and infuriated lots of progressives in the Democratic Party. But still, she was carrying the Democratic label. The Democratic Party went along with it. It was, to some extent, it was part of their strategy of running horses for courses, different candidates in different parts of the country, centrists in Republican-leaning areas, progressives in progressive-leaning areas. And it was a big success with that strategy. And if you talk to people down in Arizona, as I did, you know, they see it as a huge win. The Democrats have been trying to do this for years, and they've never got over the hump, and they managed it, unlike in Texas, where Beto O'Rourke obviously ran a great race but just came up a bit short.
So Arizona, Texas, two conservative states where Democratic candidates, Sinema in Arizona, Beto O'Rourke in Texas, ran notably strong campaigns for Senate this year. Can you compare the way those two races went and the way that the two Republican candidates in the race, Martha McSally in Arizona, Ted Cruz in Texas, responded to those challenges?
Yeah, they were two very different races. I mean, Martha McSally basically equivocated on Trump early in the race. She defeated two Trumpian opponents, including Joe Arpaio, in the primary. And then she gradually tacked towards Trump in the campaign as it got tighter and tighter and embraced him pretty fully towards the end. He went down there and had a bigger rally for her. And she said, you know, Donald Trump's turned America around. So by that stage, she was pretty much on board with him. But at the same time, she was trying to portray to the sort of swing voters in Arizona that she would be sort of independent. But you can't really be that independent if you stood on stage with Donald Trump, let's be honest. And I think that that went against her in the end. And what happened really was Sinema ran a very disciplined race aimed specifically at the sort of Republican swing voters, which were important all over the country, of course, specifically well-educated women in the suburbs. And that was what this message of being independent and not beholden to anybody and willing to cross party lines specifically directed at them. And though it infuriated a lot of Liberal Democrats, it turned out it worked in the campaign. Beto O'Rourke, on the other hand, in Texas, ran a pretty full-blooded progressive campaign, attacking Trump on the wall, defending traditional liberal positions in the Democratic Party, and trying to mobilize the Democratic base, especially young people and Latinos. And he did a great job about that. Even the people in Arizona were full of praise for what Beto O'Rourke did in Texas, because Texas is less friendly territory for Democrats than Arizona is. But in the end, he did come up a couple of percentage points short. So going ahead, obviously, there's a question for the Democrats: which strategy do you take in 2020? Do you take the O'Rourke line and try and enthuse the base, run a full-blooded progressive campaign? Or do you sort of trim and hedge like Sinema did and try to appeal to centrists?
Right. And so on election night, the feeling from pundits and strategists was that the blue wave, quote unquote, had failed to materialize. And Sinema's win is one of several that have been called in the days since Election Day that have made it seem like, rather than being just a kind of modest success, that this election was actually a real significant moment for the Democratic Party.
I mean, you might as well go with a cliche. I mean, I don't think it was a tidal wave, but it was certainly a blue wave. I think what happened is, just because of the accident of timing and the way the results came in, it looked a lot worse for the Democrats and better for the Republicans early on, because Florida came in first. That looks like a disaster, and everybody for Democrats, and it was like, oh my God, it's 2016 all over again. Because if you remember then, the results from the Panhandle came in, and that was the first indication that things weren't going to work out well for Hillary. I think a lot of Democrats, especially who lived through that, saw the same thing happening again, especially when they then saw the states in the upper Midwest. And when they saw what was happening in Missouri, and when they saw what was happening in North Dakota, where Democrats, longtime incumbent Democrats, were being swept out, not just being defeated narrowly, but swept out, you know, it started to look like a very good night for the Republicans. And a lot of Republicans, including Trump himself, immediately seized upon this to make it look like either a Republican victory or a split verdict. The results in most of the country hadn't come in then. Now they have come in from most of the country, and we can see that actually it was a very significant victory for the Democrats. They're going to end up winning about perhaps 40 seats in the House of Representatives. They've virtually swept some areas. In New Jersey, there's only one Republican left. In Orange County in California, which when I started reporting on American politics was a bastion of sort of Nixonite conservatism, there are now no Republicans. It looks like the Democrats have won by about 7 or 8 percentage points. Looks like they're making as big a wins as they did after Watergate. It was a big win. In the Senate, of course, the electoral map was very favorable to the Republicans, so the Democrats didn't do quite as well. But they did make, looks like, at least 2 pickups now in Arizona and Nevada. And basically, the balance of the Senate doesn't look like it's going to change very much. Yeah.
There's 3 big races that are still sort of being hashed out in some way. The Senate and gubernatorial races in Florida, and then the gubernatorial race in Georgia. You know, do you have thoughts on where those races are?
From what everything we read, it seems like it's unlikely that any of these results are going to be overturned. In Georgia, as I understand it, there are just too many votes against Stacey Abrams as things stand. So she's basically been, her campaign is now facing the option of either accepting the results or challenging the entire election in a lawsuit, which seems like a bit of a long shot. In Florida, they have announced a manual recount for the Senate race, and the governor's race seems to be pretty much over with the Republican DeSantis winning. Most of the people who you see quoted, including some Democratic officials off the record, think it's very unlikely that the result in the Senate race in Florida will be overturned either. So I'm not ruling out further lawsuits, and the squabbling may continue for a long time, but the conventional wisdom in political circles is at the heel of the hunt. All of these results will stand.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So let's start looking ahead to the incoming Congress, especially the House. Do you think Pelosi ends up as Speaker?
Well, you know, I'm not up on Capitol Hill sort of canvassing votes, but if I had to make a bet, I would say that she will. There's two types of opposition. There are the opponents in the swing seats who, because they were trying to appeal to Republican voters and she's a bogeywoman for Republicans or has been made into one, they had to sort of distance themselves from her in the election. So they have already said on the record, we won't support Pelosi. So they're sort of stuck. Then there's obviously a progressive movement who think that Pelosi's too old and not liberal enough, and they're sort of putting the squeeze on her. From what I read and from the fact that she does seem to be eliciting support from lots of sort of establishment and progressive groups, I think Pelosi will probably see off the challenge.
So she's already started to telegraph her approach to being Speaker, if indeed she is. And it sounds like the strategy will be to focus on policy and to kind of put the brakes on any kind of impeachment talk. What do you think is informing that approach?
You know, you've got a very interesting situation on Capitol Hill now because the incentives in the House and the Senate are very different. In the House, Pelosi and her colleagues, I think, are very wary of the 1990s precedent when the Republicans pushed through impeachment of Bill Clinton and it rebounded horribly against them. The president ended up with a very high approval rating. The Republicans in Congress ended up with a very low approval rating. And it was basically a disaster for the Republicans. So the Democrats, I think, are very wary of that. They're wary of alienating the sort of centrists out there in the country, to the extent there are any centrists left. And it looks like they're going to, I don't think they're going to rule out indictment, pending whatever Mueller comes up with in his report. But at least to begin with, they're going to focus on the issues they focused on in the campaign, which were healthcare, Social Security, Medicare, infrastructure, traditional Democratic issues, which they know their voters respond to and which the Republicans don't really have an argument against. And I think that's politically, that's a sensible strategy, I think. But at the same time, you've got a lot of very, very motivated, very angry people at the base of the Democratic Party who, you know, their argument is, look, we were the guys who elected you. We were out knocking on doors. We want to get rid of Trump. They can't ignore those people. And this is going to be the constituent to some extent of the Democratic primary in 2020. So Democrats in the Senate, lots of whom are now running or are thinking about running for the nomination, have got a different set of incentives to Pelosi. They're thinking about appealing to the primary electorate in 2020 rather than the general electorate.
Right. And so talk a little bit about the kinds of tensions that we're already seeing from some of these 2020 candidates in contrast to the kind of moderate approach that Pelosi is taking.
Well, you can see, I think, in the response to what's happening in Florida and also in Georgia. Earlier in the week, I noticed Cory Booker, Senator for New Jersey, who seems pretty certain to launch a presidential bid, basically came out and said, point blank, the race has been stolen. The Republicans have stolen the race from Stacey Abrams. Putting himself out there, first one on the record to say that. And within hours, Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, who just won re-election and is also eyeing a run for the presidency, came out and said exactly the same thing, that the race had been stolen. I think the incentive there, again, is to be sort of not outflanked on the left, not to lose control of the base, reflect some of the anger in the base. It's just an example, I think, of what we're going to see ahead, where these senators are going to be driven primarily by their electoral ambitions, whereas the leaders of the party, especially in the House, are thinking about the general election.
And so, okay, so we've got the 2020 candidates who are running to the left. We've got the House Democrats that are trying to sort of be more deliberate. And then there's the third factor here, which is how Trump reacts to both of these approaches. And what do you make of that?
Well, who knows what Trump will do. I mean, so far he just seems to be raving, doesn't he? I mean, after the results. I mean, he's always raving, but he's raving even more than usual in the week or so since the elections. He maybe even persuaded himself on election night that he was telling the truth when he said it was a great victory for the Republicans. But from all we know, he's been obsessing over all the recounts since then, watching the results coming in from California, seeing a lot of candidates who he went out and endorsed being defeated. He's got to know by this stage that it was a big defeat for his party and a big repudiation of him personally. How he's going to deal with it once we get to January and Congress comes back into session again, I think he's obviously already put out there in his initial press conference his sort of offer. He's basically saying, okay, I'm willing to cooperate with you guys. Maybe we'll do an infrastructure bill. Maybe you guys have got some ideas. Send them to me. But the price of that is no investigations whatsoever. If you start investigating me or still less impeaching me, it's going to be all-out war. And we'll just have to see how the Democrats react. And, of course, everybody's waiting to see what Mueller does because that will inform what the Democrats do on the Russian investigation.
John, thanks. John Cassidy is a staff writer at The New Yorker and a regular contributor to NewYorker.com. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. We'll be off next week for Thanksgiving, returning the week of November 26th. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Hannah Wilentz for NewYorker.com. I'm Eric Latch, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden.